Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art. Located near the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2444.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this first hour of the show today, we'll be talking with one of the country's leading constitutional law scholars. His name is Akhil Amar, and he's on the faculty at Yale at the law school there, where he's been a member of the faculty since 1985. He also got his law degree there. He says that the Constitution of the United States is a thing that deserves careful study and has a great deal to teach us if we would only listen. And to that end, he has produced a book, something that he calls an opinionated biography. It's an attempt to look at the Constitution and explain not just what it says, but also to try to dig into why it says it. What were some of the things that were in the minds of the framers at the time the Constitution was put together? He says that this relatively compact document, and indeed it is short, a small pamphlet will contain it. He says that this document reflects the story of America as a whole, and he says it has been far more democratic a document than is commonly understood. His book, America's Constitution, A Biography, is published by Random House. It came out last fall, so certainly you should be able to find it in the bookstore, in the library, if you'd like to read the book. And here on the program, questions are welcome. I would certainly encourage people to call in if there are specific things about the Constitution that you would be interested in discussing with our guest. Do that, please do. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we do have a toll-free line, and that means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and the call's on us. That's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Amar, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure that most people listening to us at some point in their school career, either in history class or civics class, sat through some discussion of the Constitution. Perhaps, let us hope, were required to read it so that they've read it at least one time, and got a little bit of a dissertation on the structure of government, all that sort of thing. So if we went out today and rounded up a representative group of American adults and gave them a very basic test on the Constitution, how well do you think your average person would do?
Maybe not so well. I think people, ordinary Americans, probably, if you ask them to give you a passage from a favorite song or a poem or a play or a TV show or from scripture, they'd be able to quote you a paragraph or two from some favorite text. I think very few Americans would be able to even, I'm not sure I actually could actually quote you word for word without the document in my hand, any provision of the Constitution. Most people who go to law school and take constitutional law classes, I don't think they're actually even assigned to read the Constitution. And if they are, it's on the first day, and then it's really not discussed very much anymore. Instead, a constitutional law class typically in college or in law school focuses on Supreme Court cases rather than the document itself.
Yeah, well, you here in the preface, you say that there's a running joke in law schools that requiring students to read the Constitution would only confuse them.
So I teach constitutional law in both Yale College and Yale Law School, and then I teach some advanced classes in the law school. And I often pull my students, how many of them who didn't have me for the basic introductory constitutional law class were actually asked to read the Constitution, and only about half of them raised their hands. Mm.
Well, the language is a little archaic, so I suppose for some people that would be a problem. But just being able to read it and understand it, is that particularly an issue?
It is an issue. The King James Bible is written in even older English, and yet lots of people actually have read and could memorize, could recite passages from that. I suspect it's probably true that more people could actually quote from Shakespeare, which is really archaic. But I do know that when I was in high school and I opened up, I think it was freshman, Romeo and Juliet, and it started with all this discussion of Collier's and coal bearing, and I had no idea what was going on, and I closed that play and never went back to it for 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I suspect some people might have a similar reaction to the Constitution, and that's why I wrote this this guidebook, as it were, to walk a general reader through the document and to get beneath the 18th century, 19th century language. Of course, the Constitution has been amended over the years, so it's not all from the 1780s, but try to walk a reader through and explain, here's what this word, this passage really is all about, and it's quite relevant today often. Hmm.
Well, let me take out another sort of old saw, and that's the one being that it's not what you don't know that's the big problem, it's what you know that's not so. If we ask the question, do you think that there are some common fundamental misunderstandings that people have about the Constitution?
I think they believe that the Supreme Court was designated as the only or the ultimate interpreter of the Constitution. In fact, when you look at it, the judiciary is listed third out of three branches, and all branches of the Constitution of the government, they're actually to play important roles in constitutional interpretation. So I think today's Americans probably have, as today's justices perhaps have, an overly inflated sense of the role of courts in the system. If they had a really good high school teacher, Americans, I think, might have been taught that the Constitution really wasn't quite so democratic, that the framers really didn't believe in democracy. I don't think that is so. I actually think the Constitution for its time was the most radically democratic document that really had ever existed in world history, and we can talk about how and why that was so. But if they had a good high school teacher, that high school teacher was trying to get them to think critically, but maybe overly so. And so if they read a Federalist paper in high school, it was probably the Federalist number 10 or maybe the Federalist number 51, neither of which were particularly significant, especially 10 wasn't read by anyone at the founding. And there were other Federalist papers that were read at the founding that were hugely important that most Americans never even heard of before. The basic argument for the federal government is probably a little different that was made by the Federalists in the 1780s was probably a little bit different than what most Americans were taught. So in a nutshell, I think most Americans don't realize how democratic the Constitution really was for its time, how unfortunately pro-slavery, how slavocratic it was. That was something that even Mr. Lincoln wanted to sort of deny in some ways because he's anti-slavery and he didn't want to be opposed to the Constitution. But it originally was rather pro-slavery. And most Americans also, I don't think, probably today understand how much the Constitution was really about national security and foreign relations, and how much the framers really had an idea of America as a world, a new world, kind of set apart from the rest of the world by these big oceans, the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans.
Well, we can discuss some of these things in some detail. We do have a caller here, so I want to get to them.
Great.
And again, if for those people who perhaps have just joined us, I'd better introduce again our guest, Akhil Amar. He is professor of law at Yale, has been on the faculty there since 1980. He has written widely on constitutional issues for a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times, and also has written books on constitutional law. And his most recent book that was published last fall is the book America's Constitution, A Biography. It's published by Random House. And as he explains, it's an attempt to walk people through the document, starting right with the preamble and going all the way through to the 27th Amendment to the Constitution, and trying to talk a little bit about not only what it says, but what it means, and something of the context, something of the thinking of the people who drafted the document. The idea is that perhaps it can give people a better understanding of the Constitution than they have today. So questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller, someone south of Danville, not all that far away from here, on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Is Dr. Amar?
Yes.
Oh, well, thank you for taking my call. I'm an ex-military officer, which really doesn't have any bearing on the topic of the day, but I have been sworn at one time to defend and support the Constitution. And what alarms me today is the attitude that it's a living document and can be changed. And what was mentioned earlier in the show, reference the Supreme Court, they seem to be pretty much at ease with interpretation of things that seem pretty radical to me. I think I'm a staunch defender of the Second Amendment, And I believe without the second, we would have no others. And I just wondered if you're, in your opinion there, is that the right to bear arms? In my understanding, and I apologize, I am not as well-read on the Constitution, probably. I'm probably below average. But I would like to get an opinion if that, to me, seems like it was put in there by the founding fathers there to protect the populace from an oppressive government. And, you know, that's one I believe that's going to be under attack again seriously in the years or so after 2008. Once again, it's been kind of quiet for the last 8 years about it, but I'm sure that's going to surface again. I just wonder what your opinion is on that Second Amendment and the right for private citizens to bear arms, and what the Founding Fathers had in mind with that.
Well, first, thanks very much for your question and also for your service to this country. We're all very grateful. I mention that because I think actually it does bear a little bit on the Second Amendment in an interesting way. America's Constitution, the written Constitution, not what judges have said about it, but the actual document, is the product in many respects of the wars that America has fought. And so that's why military service is really important. That's why I said originally the Constitution was more about national security than is conventionally understood. And the Second Amendment is a very good illustration of how even if you don't believe in a living Constitution, but you just believe in the written Constitution as originally adopted and amended, things can be a little complicated and meanings can change over the years. At the founding, the Second Amendment was a reflection of the American Revolution, and the ideology there was that a central an imperial government it was dangerous, and that liberty was associated with local governments. The states banded together, the colonies, to fight an imperial government way off in London that had professional soldiers. And the heroes of the American Revolution were local governments, the individual colonies that banded together, and local militias at Lexington and Concord and Bunker's Hill. And so the ideology of local people banding together to resist central tyranny, that was a central vision of the original Second Amendment. It's connected to other things in the Constitution, local juries that would keep a watch on central judges, for example, and central prosecutors. A local militia is really very similar to a local jury. It's organized by the folks in the community. It's amateurs sort of against professionals. And originally, the Second Amendment, the phrase bear arms, isn't quite so much about individuals having guns in homes to protect themselves against burglars and things like that. It's a military idea. Bearing arms is a military phrase. And the Third Amendment, which is right next to the Second, is all about quartering of troops. So there's anxiety about a central military, the British Redcoats, and a faith in local militias. Now, there's a 60 years later, 70 years later, you know, the war comes, Mr. Lincoln says, a civil war, and now, actually, in that war, the local militias aren't sort of quite seen as the same heroes of our constitutional story. Local militias took up arms against the central government. The hero of the Civil War was actually Grant's army, the Boys in Blue, the military that you served. And after the Civil War, the Constitution is amended, and one of the amendments, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, in effect, reflected a somewhat different vision of arms bearing in America. And the framers of the 14th Amendment thought that arms bearing needed to be reconceptualized a little bit, and they believed in a more individual right to bear arms rather than the right of the local militia. The National Rifle Association, actually, the NRA, was formed after the Civil War by a group of ex-Union Army officers. And many of the ideas that people today have about an individual right to bear arms, even outside the military context, even someone who's not a voter, for example, a woman who's not part of the militia, who's not a juror, who's not a voter in 1787 or 1868, the idea was she still needed perhaps to have a right to defend her home. And in particular, if she was a black woman or a black man in a home, she needed to have a right to have a firearm in her home to protect her, not just from the government, but from private violence, from the Klan, and so on. And it's a much more individualistic right of arms bearing, a much less military vision of arms bearing, one in which actually there's not quite as much confidence in a local government. You can't quite trust the local militia, and you can't even trust the local sheriff, perhaps. So it's a different vision of arms bearing than what the framers had. So even if you don't believe in living constitution, you had one Second Amendment at the founding that reflects the American Revolution and a slightly different vision of arms bearing after the Civil War, embodied in the 14th Amendment.
I see. Okay, well, that certainly sheds a little different light on it to me, and I look forward to getting your book and educating myself a little further on things I should already know.
Thanks for your call.
All right.
Thank
well,
you very much.
Thanks for the call. Let me just—I don't want to turn this entire conversation into a discussion of the Second Amendment, but let me raise one further question, and that is: how though do we think, and does the Constitution really give much guidance about the issue of, or the question of, what sort of authority, or does in fact the government have any authority to do any kind of regulating of ownership of arms?
Mm-hmm. The Second Amendment is an interesting counterexample to what we were talking about before. I think, and lots of my colleagues at Yale and in various blue states around the country might not like what I'm about to say, but because they're much more keen on the First Amendment than the Second. But the Second Amendment might be an exception. It's an amendment that lots of Americans actually may have memorized word for word. It sort of has a connection to the culture today in a way that many other provisions of the Constitution have kind of lost a sense. And so just to remind everyone what the words of the Second Amendment are that we're talking about, which, again, lots of Americans maybe have just committed to memory, but here it is in its entirety. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And some people emphasize, well, it says militia, and it talks about a well-regulated militia, and shouldn't government be able to regulate it? And other people focus on other language of the Constitution, of that amendment, saying, well, forget the militia, it talks about the right of the people to keep and bear arms. And so which is it? Is it about the militia? Is it about the people? And what does regulation mean? And at the founding, you see, the militia and the people were two ways of saying basically the same thing. The people were we the people who ordained and established the Constitution and the preamble. They're the voters. And plus or minus, with a little bit just of fuzziness at the edges, at the founding, the same people who voted were the people who served on your juries and who served in the militia. So the militia and the people were two ways of saying basically the same thing, that in a free state, in a democratic state, those who vote should be part of your military, should bear arms, and those who were part of your military should vote. And what we shouldn't have is reliance on a group of paid professional soldiers. They might be aliens, they might be Hessians, they might be mercenaries who are not really responsive to the citizenry. So just like your jury should look like America, just like on election day the people who come out should look like America, so should the militia. And the militia was subject to certain kinds of regulations. The state, for example, might pass laws saying who serves in the militia, just as it passes laws saying who serves in a jury and how a jury is picked. But that regulation didn't quite extend to the idea of getting rid of the militia or getting rid of the jury or getting rid of elections. So we have regulation of who votes, who serves on juries, who serves in militias, but regulation didn't quite equal prohibition. So that's a good example of just how, in order to understand all the words they're using, free state, well-regulated militia people bear arms, you kind of have to put yourself back in the historical context of the 1780s. And today we have voting, we have jury service. We don't quite have regular militia service the way we did 200 years ago. Switzerland has it. Israel has a version of it, but we don't quite have it today. Our quote-unquote militia is really paid, semi-professional volunteers of a very different sort than was true at the founding.
Well, we have a number of other callers, and I want to give more people a chance to get involved here in the conversation. The only thing I would say is you can help us by trying to be brief in your comments. And well, I don't mean you, Professor Amar, but maybe everybody would help us to try to be a little bit brief, just in the interest of getting in as many people as we possibly can. And again, our guest this morning is Akhil Amar, and he's professor of law at Yale Law School. He is the author of the book published last fall, America's Constitution, a Biography. And let us go on, and we'll talk next with somebody here on cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi. I have two very brief comments and then a broader question for you. The first comment is simply to point out, and I'm sure you're aware of this book, I don't recall the title, but it's one that points out that the founding fathers were probably the most intellectual and scientifically literate group of politicians, actually, of any just group in its days, and that a lot of its principles on which the founded come from the Newtonian scientific revolution. The second comment is most people actually don't even believe in the Constitution if you go through it line by line and amendment by amendment, and that the real belief is sort of this mystical thing that we've been indoctrinated, I hate to use that word, with. And that now I have the general question, and that is this. When the Constitution was first formulated and voted on, George Mason, which apparently is only known for its basketball team, George Mason was one of the founding fathers, except that he refused to sign the Constitution because it didn't have some items in it, which eventually became the Bill of Rights. And surely then it meant that the people who founded, who set up the Constitution, must have been aware that there were going to be changes needed. And did they make any allowance other than amendments? Or in order to do that, did they intentionally not want any changes? Because that's what we're talking about when we talk about a living Constitution, not just adding new things, but actually reinterpreting the words, which is what you were just discussing. So if you could go into that a little bit, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay.
Just as the Constitution was the product of the American Revolution when it was adopted in the 1780s, so too was the product of a broader Enlightenment movement. Yes, these were people who proposed it and ratified it, who believed in science and reason and general principles of Enlightenment. One of the ideas, the biggest idea, really, of their Enlightenment philosophy was that democracies should be preferred to old world systems of monarchy and aristocracy, so the document is put up to a vote. And here's the amazing thing. People were allowed to vote against it. It was a free election. It wasn't fixed at all. And some of the people that we celebrate the most today, people like George Mason, opposed the Constitution. It was okay to be on either side of that debate. You had great men on one side, like George Washington and Ben Franklin, and very prominent people on the other side. People who voted against the Constitution go on to be President of the United States, James Monroe, Supreme Court Justices, Samuel Chase, respected elder statesman, George Mason. So it's remarkable because in ancient Greece, constitutions weren't put up to a vote. The Declaration of Independence hadn't been put up to a vote. None of the state constitutions in 1776 was put up to a vote. The Articles of Confederation wasn't put up to a vote. The Constitution was, and it was a year-long process. It was the first time really in history that so many people had been allowed to vote on the document under which they and their posterity would be governed. And if you voted no, you weren't thrown out of the system. You were brought in, and one of the things that you were told is, okay, we hear you, we know you have some objections, stick around because we can make changes together. So George Mason says there's no Bill of Rights, and so people say, you're right, that was maybe a mistake, that the original Constitution doesn't have a Bill of Rights, so stick around and help us frame a Bill of Rights. Help us amend the thing, make amendments to improve it. And that's one of the ways in which the losers were kept part of the process. You see in Iraq today or something how difficult it is not only to get something through, to get a yes vote, but to keep the losers on board while getting a yes vote. That's a very difficult thing to do, and the framers managed it brilliantly, and they managed it by telling the people who lost, we've heard your objections, we think some of them have merit, let's work together to make amends. And I think they tended to talk more about not creative reinterpretation, but if the document is mistaken, let's get together and amend it, as we have over the course of American history. And many of the things that we most celebrate are the amendments, the Bill of Rights, ending slavery in the 13th Amendment, promising everyone that it would be an equal citizen in the 14th, giving black men the vote, and then women of all races. So many of the things that we most celebrate today, Enlightenment ideas actually, are products of later amendments. And George Mason kind of begins that process by saying, I'm going to vote against it because it needs to be improved.
So here, this is, and I apologize, I got other callers and we'll get to them, but this is a fundamental thing about which we continue to argue, and that the two poles of the discussion are those people who say on the one hand that it is, that the Constitution is what it is, it says what it says, what the framers wrote when they wrote it, it is eternal and unchanging. On the one hand, and the other people who say, no, that's not what they had in mind. They recognize the fact that in the future, the country might be a different place than it is now. And so, for that reason, they built into it a way of amending it. They didn't want it to be easy, but they didn't want it to be impossible. And so that they had the idea that perhaps the document would evolve as the country would evolve. It sounds as if you're coming down on the side that says, yes, in fact, that was what the framers had in mind, that they did not intend for it to be what it was at that moment forever and ever and no changes.
And they struck the balance that they struck turns out to be, in retrospect, rather impressive when you think about how few bad amendments there have been and how almost all the amendments, from our perspective today, have really improved the system. There's been very little backsliding. So the Constitution, it had its limitations on democracy. Women didn't vote, for example. There were property qualifications, yet still more people were allowed to vote on the Constitution, yes or no, than had ever been allowed to vote on anything before in human history. So it was better than what happened the day before, and that was true. That's been true of most of the amendments. The Bill of Rights, they're not perfect, but they made the system better than it was the day before. Getting rid of slavery, well, still lots more work needed to be done, but it made the system better than it was before. And then that was the 13th Amendment after the Civil War. And then the 14th Amendment comes along and says not only no slavery, but equal citizenship. And then the 15th Amendment comes along and says not only no slavery, not only equal citizenship, but blacks get to vote on equal terms. And then the 19th Amendment says women get to vote on equal terms. And direct election of the Senate and getting rid of poll taxes. And so when you look actually at the amendments over the time, some of them were in the 1900s, some of them were in the 20th century. And some of them were in the 1800s. When you look at all these things, the amendments have, in general, continued this Enlightenment project. They've made our system more equal and fair and more free.
Yeah, I think you make an important point here, something that you say a lot of people perhaps don't know, and that was that when it came time for people to vote, those people who were allowed to vote on the Constitution, that a lot of states waived their property requirements, because it was true at the time that to be able to vote, you had to own property. And in a lot of cases, that was, in this particular case, for voting on the Constitution, that was waived. So people got a chance to vote on this that ordinarily wouldn't have been able to.
And after 20 years of teaching constitutional law at Yale, I didn't know that before I started researching the book. None of my friends who teach constitutional law knew that, because we were all influenced, as our most educated Americans, by a man named Charles Beard, who wrote a very famous book at the beginning of the 20th century saying the Constitution was of, by, and for the rich. It was the propertied folks pulling a fast one on everyone else. And that's why lots of people have been taught in high school, if they had a good high school teacher, that the Constitution really wasn't democratic. And I came to think that Beard basically got it fundamentally wrong. The Constitution was much more democratic than anything that had existed before in general. And that getting rid of property qualifications in that special "we do" election of the founding, "we the people do ordain this Constitution," that's how it starts, with a remarkably democratic act of a continental people.
We have other callers, and I want to get back to them. Let me again quickly introduce the guest, Akhil Amar. He is professor of law at Yale Law School. Has been on the faculty there since 1985. His book, if you would like to read it, is published last fall, is America's Constitution, a Biography, published by Random House. The next caller is in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, there are two questions that I'd like you to pursue. One is having to do with religion, and it's to what extent you think the Constitution is a platform that we can use to keep the domination of one particular tradition or religion from dictating what happens in public spaces. And then two, there's this recent idea that the government should be afraid of the people and not the other way around. And I was wondering if you thought there was any kind of support in the historical record for that idea as well. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call.
On the issue of religion, we see once again what an Enlightenment document it was and how far ahead of its time it was, how liberal and equal it was. There are no religious qualifications in order to be a federal office holder. And in fact, the federal Constitution in Article 6 says religious tests are prohibited. So people of all faiths and even of no faith are eligible to be judges and congresspeople and president of the United States. No state constitution had such a guarantee in 1787, not one. In 11 of the 13 state constitutions, they were actually in the state constitution itself, religious requirements for office holding. Some states said you had to believe in an afterlife. Other states said you actually have to believe in the Gospels or be a Christian. Some said you have to just believe in a God. Some said you have to believe in the Trinity. Some said you had to be a Protestant, so even Catholics were ineligible. That was the state constitutions. But the federal constitution says no religious tests of office holding. The oath of office provision for the president is really interesting, not so much for what it says as what it doesn't say. It doesn't say, as the English monarch, when he or she took the coronation oath, had to swear to be the defender of the faith. The ceremony had to be administered by a bishop or an archbishop. You had to kiss the Protestant Bible, the King James Bible, to seal the ceremony, and you had to swear on that Bible. You had to say the words, "So help me God." None of these things are part of the oath of office for the president. People are permitted to be religious. So George Washington, when he takes the first oath of office, adds as a personal matter the words, "So help me God." And so people who are religious are absolutely eligible to say so in the public square and to bring their faith background as part of who they are. But there's no governmental requirement that they be of this denomination or that one or even any denomination. Two of the four guys up there on Mount Rushmore, Mr. Lincoln and Mr. Jefferson, were not members of any formal denomination when they were elected president of the United States. So ours is a system that from the beginning, even before the First Amendment came along, which is part of the Bill of Rights, was remarkably open on the religion issue. And it connects to the second question. Instead of having all sorts of qualifications for who can be president, you have to be this faith or that one or have this amount of property, we leave it up to the people. There are very, very few restrictions on who can be president or who can be Congress, no property qualifications, because our system basically trusts the people, trusts the voters to make that decision for themselves.
All right. Let's go to Charleston, Illinois, line number 4. Hello?
Yes. Is there anything in the Constitution to prohibit a state
from leaving the Union.
Yes. And so Mr. Lincoln was absolutely right on that. No state may unilaterally secede from the Union. Article 6 actually says the Constitution trumps any state law to the contrary, or state constitutional provision. So Articles 5 and 7 reinforce this. There's a provision of Article 3 that defines treason as taking up arms against the United States, and that's even if your state is encouraging you to do it, you're still guilty of treason. The entire federal constitution was basically a plan to create an indivisible union of 13 formerly separate sort of states that had been linked together only in a loose confederation, kind of like NATO or the United Nations. And the entire Constitution is an effort to take those different states and fuse them into one indivisible union, a more perfect union, to borrow from the preamble, on the model of the Union of Scotland and England in 1707, when these two previously separate kingdoms decided to form one island nation. And the reason why the Union has to be indivisible is because is for national security purposes, to eliminate land borders. Because if one state unilaterally secedes and it's got a land border up against another state, then it can build up an army, and then the state on the other side has to build up an army. And the result of this arms race is you're going to have strong men, military figures emerge who use armies to suppress citizens domestically, and you'll have tyranny. The Federalists look around the planet and they say there are only two places in the world that are tolerably free, not Asia, not Africa, not China or Turkey, or most of Europe groans in chains, but Britain is relatively free and so are the Swiss. Why? Because the Swiss have the mountains of the Alps and Britain has an English Channel. It's hard to invade because it's an island nation. We in America have to form our own island nation. We have to take 13 separate states, make them one island nation, and then we won't need a big army. We can rely on this huge moat called the Atlantic Ocean, a very small navy, and we will be free because we won't have big standing armies. And in order for all that to work, states cannot be allowed to unilaterally secede. Mr. Lincoln was 100% right on that, and that's my view.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Bloomington, Indiana, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I hope I'm not asking a question you've already answered. I haven't been able to give your program my full attention, but I heard you talking about George Mason and his insistence on Bill of Rights. And I understand that George Mason had a great deal to do with writing the Virginia Constitution. He may even have had something to do with the Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom. And I think George Mason was even a main author of the Bill of Rights in the Virginia Constitution, which defined freedom of religion. And in that case, as I understand it, let's see if I get this right. George Mason and his friends who wrote the Virginia Bill of Rights defined religion as the duty we owe to God. In other words, there wasn't, as you've already commented, some of these states had established religion. The Virginia Statute of Religious Freedom did away with an established church in Virginia, but religion was still defined by George Mason in the Virginia Bill of Rights as the duty we owe to God. In other words, it wasn't freedom from religion. It was assumed men owed a duty to God, but freedom of religion granted men to discharge that duty. This is almost the wording that George Mason uses, the freedom to discharge that duty as they see fit. How am I doing?
You're doing great. Three or four quick reactions. One, you're absolutely right in looking at state constitutions and trying to compare them to the federal constitution. Lots of people talk about Locke or Montesquieu, or the people at Philadelphia basically were shaped by the state constitutional experience of the 13 states. And what you want to see is where they copied language from the 13 states and when they choose to break with it. So that language is in the Virginia Constitution about the duty we owe to the Creator, but it isn't quite in the federal constitution. And so it's interesting to look at what they borrowed, an idea of a Bill of Rights, and where they changed it a little bit. Theirs was less of a religious document than was the Virginia document. But a second thing that you are saying is many, many of the people who believe that government should not have any business, should not play any role in the religious business, did so because they actually were people of faith. They didn't want government monkeying in religion. They wanted to leave that up to individuals as a matter of private faith and conscience to decide what really were their religious views. So people who are religious, many people who are religious, want to keep the government out of the religion business, partly to protect religion and its integrity and purity.
That's right. Freedom of religion is to protect the religious people from government, not to protect the government from the religious people.
And that's why I said George Washington was absolutely within his rights as a matter of personal faith when he chose to add the words, "So help me God," when he took his first oath of office and his second. And every one of his successors has chosen to do it, but there's no law that requires them to. And if a president wants to omit those words because that's how he understands his relationship to the universe, then he or she would be free not to add those because the government isn't imposing any kind of creed or religious dogma on government officials.
We just have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and I have a number of other callers, and I hope, again, the caller will forgive me for trying to get at least one more person in. The next in line is in Savoy, so we'll go there. Line 2.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Hi.
Yeah, hey, I've always thought that the Constitution was a perfect document in many, many ways. And one of the reasons I came to that conclusion is I've read the Constitution of Canada and some other place and the European Union. And the brevity of the U.S. Constitution is unique whenever you compare it to those documents. And then the Constitution, it gets right down to business and it says, hey, This is going to be the law of the land. Here's how it's going to work. Here's what people, you know, it's very explicit that the power remains in the people's hands. And then it also addresses commerce, too. And I felt that the Commerce Clause has held us together, you know, and I'd like to know what you like to think, you know, what you think on that. And then I had one other comment on the Second Amendment. I think the reason that there's two phrases there. One regards the regulation of a militia, and then also the expression of individual rights to bear arms. The founders, I think that's a tactical reason. The founders realized to protect yourself, you also have to have heavy weapons, and the militia should have the heavy weapons, and the individual should have, so more or less, the light arms. And whenever you look at that, to this day, even the state governors have under their command warplanes. And I think that was the original intent there.
Well, we'll get some thoughts here from Professor Amar.
I won't say anything more about the Second Amendment, having talked about that at length earlier, but I do absolutely agree with you that one brilliant aspect of our Constitution is its brevity. Why was it so short? Not so that judges could make stuff up, which is what some of my judge friends think. Oh, it's short so that we can add all sorts of things. It's short so that ordinary people could read it. Ordinary people actually had to read it 200 years ago to decide in this special election, the likes of which had never before been seen in world history. Ordinary people had to read it to decide whether they were going to go vote for it or against it. So it had to be short enough so that a farmer could read the thing. And it does get down to business pretty quickly. The preamble tells you it's a more perfect union. It comes from the people. And then it starts to tell you how the powers of government are going to be outlined. But from that first sentence, it tells you that it's about the people.
All right. Well, again, let's try to get in at least one more caller here. This would be somebody on a cell phone in line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
I guess there will be a slight Second Amendment. I think the myth of the militia as the hero of the Revolutionary War is really, well, it's a myth. I mean, it was, and the poor regular army gets dashed, but, I mean, it was, it's pretty well known for military history of the Revolutionary War, which, alas, a lot of people don't read, that the militia didn't show up. They showed up sometimes, but frequently would disband and leave, and wouldn't stick around. And there's a famous, I think it was General Green, who said to his militia, "Give me 2 shots, and then you can run." And that was about as good of the performance as they got. I mean, these guys can't stand against regulars. I'm not saying that there's something wrong with the militia, but a lot of the same kinds of things happened again in the Civil War, and the final straw was in the mobilization for the Spanish-American War, when it was found out that the armories of many of the militias had essentially been looted. And so that's why we have the National Guard now, because essentially they just couldn't count on them. So I guess I understand what they were writing, but I, you know, I also think that perhaps on this particular point they may have been wrong. So I'm going to hang up and let you guys comment.
All right.
I think I agree with that. The Second Amendment reflects a romanticized view of the role of the militia. George Washington did not think the militia did very well, neither did Alexander Hamilton, and says so pretty explicitly in The Federalist. But the Constitution itself, in the Bill of Rights, does in effect codify this slightly romanticized vision, that it says in effect a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. And over the course of American history, it has become clear that it's somewhat difficult for the amateurs to hold their own against professionals. We could ask similar questions about the jury. Can a jury of amateurs really decide all sorts of tort cases about pollution and the rest, or do we need the Environmental Protection Agency, which is able to do all sorts of hard science about what's toxic and what's not? Can a jury decide what's safe food or not, or do we need a Food and Drug Administration? So what really is it sensible to ask people to vote on? Because they are amateurs, and some of what government needs to do is serious business, and so you need professionals. So the Constitution may reflect certain romanticized conceptions of the militia, of the jury, of voters, and yet, to some extent, we need to hold on to those romanticized conceptions if we're going to hold on to some of our deep ideals.
We have about 2 minutes left. There's one other thing I want you to talk about a little bit before we finish. Back at the beginning, you said that there are a number of things that perhaps people misunderstand about the Constitution. They don't appreciate how democratic a document it is. They don't appreciate how pro-slavery a document it is. And the third thing is that they don't appreciate the dimensions, the national security and foreign relations dimensions that it has. Maybe you could talk just a little bit now here, we're at the end, about that.
So about national security, the basic idea, what makes us free? If you'd asked me 20 years ago, I would have said, oh, courts and the Bill of Rights and individual rights. And 10 years ago, I might have said, oh, it's the structure of government, because lots of governments have rights on paper, but they don't mean anything in communist China or Russia. So it's the division of powers, federalism and checks and balances and separation of powers. And today, I think I would say what's made us most free is our oceans. Because we formed an indivisible union with this huge 3,000-mile-wide moat called the Atlantic Ocean, we were a new world unto ourselves. We didn't need any major standing army to speak of in peacetime. We didn't have one for the first 150 years, so we didn't have to pay for one, and it didn't threaten liberty. We were basically able to rely on a small navy and a very modest army that would basically kill the Indians and control the continent. And so what has made us free largely is our geography, and so in World War II, it's only Pearl Harbor, you know, and it's not Chicago or Detroit or New York or San Francisco. And the challenge for our generation is that that model of a new world separated from the rest won't work for the next 200 years. It doesn't make sense with the internet and avian flu and global warming and 9/11. You know, 9/11 is the first time foreigners drew blood on American soil since the War of 1812. And so we need new models. Their model was, we'll be a world unto ourselves in our own hemisphere, and we can't quite do that anymore because we're part of one world. So we need, this next generation needs to come up with new ideas that will keep us free for the next 200 years.
Hmm. The last amendment, the one that was really a new amendment, if we don't count the 27th, would be the 26th, and that was adopted in 1971. That makes you wonder, will we ever see another amendment?
Well, I think we will, and amendments often come from young adults. People who supported the Constitution tended to be younger than people who opposed it. Many of them were soldiers, and they knew how badly the military had done, and that we needed to beef up our national security. The 26th Amendment is the Vietnam War. Just as we talked about the Revolution, the Civil War, women got the vote in World War I, and black men got the vote after the Civil War. And in Vietnam, 18-year-olds who were old enough to fight and die in that war said, "Well, we want to vote too."
Hmm.
So I think the next generation, these amendments tend to come from the younger generation.
Well, with much, much more to be said, there we must stop because we've come to the end of the time. The book that we have talked about is America's Constitution, A Biography. It's published by Random House, came out last fall, so certainly you should be able to find the book, by our guest Akhil Amar. He is professor of law at Yale Law School. And Professor Amar, thank you very much.
This was great. Thanks to your listeners.
Support for the show, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. Later on today, as part of the Afternoon Magazine, a conversation about poetry. Gwendolyn Brooks said that poetry was life distilled. And for arts journalist Rebecca Presson-Mosby, poetry offers an opportunity for reflection. Coming up later today on the Afternoon Magazine, a conversation with Mosby about her latest project, which is titled Poetry on Record. It's a collection of 98 poets reading their own work. And it tells the story of poetry in English from Romanticism to free verse and beyond. And if that name sounds familiar, as Rebecca Presson, she hosted the weekly public radio program New Letters on the Air from 1983 until 1995. And while producing and hosting that show, featuring poets and writers, she also worked for NPR member station KCUR as a news host and arts reporter. So coming up today on the Afternoon Magazine in the 1 o'clock hour, Poetry on Record with Rebecca Presson-Mosby. She'll be talking with Celeste Quinn. She's the host. And the show itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other kind of information. Well, in the next part of this show, Focus 580, we have a practical program for you, something that we do from time to time that we hope is helpful, and that is a show dedicated to helping you deal with insect pests in the home or in the garden. Phil Nixon will be with us. He's an extension entomologist at the University of Illinois, and if you have a bug problem, just call in and tell us about it. And he will tell you what to do to get rid of them. Right now, though, as usual, we will take a break. We'll have news from NPR at 1 minute past the hour. Before that, an update on the markets. So stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois. Producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly.